This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. White nose syndrome is a highly infectious disease caused by an invasive fungus introduced into caves in North America. It particularly affects the species of bats that hibernate in caves and mines in the wintertime. In Vermont, we have 9 native species of bats. 6 of those hibernate in caves in the winter. Scott Darling, wildlife biologist at the Department of Fish and Wildlife, says this has been a devastating illness.
It was first documented in New York in 2006 and Vermont in 2008. And since then, we've lost upwards of 90% of some of our bat species. And it's killed about maybe an estimated 5 to 7 million bats across the U.S.
Biologists and researchers have been struggling to come up with a plan to stop the spread of the illness without much success. But for whatever bats are able to survive, it's crucial that they have suitable habitat to breed, give birth, and forage for insects. To that end, Don Mitchell has been doing some work on his farm to make it as attractive as possible to bats. He entered his land into Vermont's current use program with a specific mission of enhancing bat habitat. It started as an experiment in reducing his tax burden after he retired from teaching at Middlebury College, but it became much more than that. And he's written a book about the experience. It's called Flying Blind: One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Don Mitchell joins us today to talk a little bit about the project and why it became so important to him. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks, Jane. It's great to be here.
So can you describe your setup so we have a vision of your land? You've got about 150 acres.
Yes, and it occupies almost a box canyon. It's walled in by cliffs both to the east and to the south and open to the west of the Adirondacks. So it has a very private purview.
And every time an official came onto your land, in the book at least, it sounded like they were awed by the beauty of what
they saw. Anybody
who
comes on our land, their jaw drops. We call it Shelburne Farms Light.
And you've used it over the years as a sheep farm. So you farm some of it has been forested the whole time, but you've been a sheep farmer.
It's about half forested and half open land. We make hay and sell hay to the market and raise a flock of sheep that has varied in size from 40 to 110.
How did you come to Vermont in the first place? You and your wife were back to the Landers in the 70s.
This was one of the most interesting cultural moments in Vermont history in the early 1970s. There was a Bible of the counterculture, long-haired, disaffected young people called the Whole Earth Catalog. No one listening under the age of 50 will know about this. But in an era when there was no internet and access to certain kinds of very specific information was difficult to come by, this phone book-sized publication came out once a year with information about how to fix your Volkswagen or build a yurt or milk a goat, and then directions to resources, books and magazines that could help you along those lines. And around 1971, the Whole Earth Catalog, there was a sidebar on maybe page 450 in which the writer advised all of the hippies to move to Vermont. Because, this writer said, it's a very small state, so we can take it over quickly.
Right, okay.
And even though everybody there seems to be a dairy farming Republican, their bedrock values are libertarian, so they will respect us. And golly, you know, 45 years later, looking back on the sociological and cultural changes in the state, that was a very prescient suggestion. So my wife and I, we always took almost any suggestion anybody gave to us at that time in our lives. And so we wound up in Vermont.
You might not have looked like the typical person to wind up in Vermont at that time, though. You may have thought of yourself as a hippie back to the Lander, but in the vision of you at the time, you were living in Los Angeles. You'd sold a screenplay. You were driving a yellow Porsche, was it?
Yes. Our first car was the Porsche, and our second car was the Porsche. But those days are long gone. I can get the same thrills now in my pickup truck at safe speeds, at legal speeds.
Well, so you were sort of disaffected with the Hollywood life, and this appealed to you to move to Vermont. And you had a little bit of money from this amazing success that you had had in your very early 20s, where you had written this book, and then it was sold in Hollywood.
I think there are moments in each person's life when they have their finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist, and you can't prepare yourself for those moments in your life. But I recognize that I'd gotten really lucky and that I did not want to go on living that sort of life.
So you move to this farm in Vermont, you buy this beautiful land, and you decide, because the Whole Earth Catalog also said, hey, sheep farming is a really good idea, that you'd try your hand at that. And then over the years, you know, as they do, priorities change. So you and your wife both took jobs to augment and then supersede your on-farm income. And you had a couple of kids, and you sort of became comfortably middle class.
Well, having kids made getting jobs necessary. All of a sudden, the dream of self-sufficient living was not going to cut it.
And then it comes time to retire. And so you've been a lecturer at Middlebury College by this point for a number of decades. And you're trying to think about not necessarily how to downsize your house, because in fact, you build an addition on it.
Yes.
But how to downsize your life, maybe. And one of the things that comes to mind is entering into the current use program so that your land is taxed less heavily. So how did you start that process and then think, and my plan is going to be to protect bats?
Well, the serendipity of this whole story is that in the summer of 2006, before white nose syndrome had been discovered in North America, Scott Darling got in touch with me and said that he had been made aware of certain features of our terrain that would make it attractive bat habitat, and he asked if he could come try and trap bats for a night with a team of technicians. And I said, golly, if you want to trap bats, I don't care. Just, you know, don't get me involved. And he had a very successful night in June of 2006, including the trapping of two Indiana bats, and these had been endangered federally since 1967. So when I was ready to enter the current use program, which requires having a forest management plan drawn up, the private forester who I consulted had a conversation with me, and he said, you know, you have a lot of shagbark hickories here. That is the premier tree that bats tend to choose to roost in during the summer in the daytime. And I said, oh, by the way, Scott Darling traps some Indiana bats here. And his eyes kind of lit up, and he realized that we could frame a forest management plan around the preservation and enhancement of the habitat that we already had going for bats.
We're talking today with Don Mitchell. He's just written a book about this experience that he's describing now, finding a way to make his land a really good habitat for endangered bats and all of the bats who are now struggling from white nose syndrome. Listeners, if you have questions about this project, you want to talk about bats, you want to talk about current use, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. But Don Mitchell, you were not exactly warm and fuzzy about bats when this all started.
No, there's a clear arc of change in this book from somebody who was terrified of bats to somebody who has a profound admiration for them, bordering on affection, yes.
How did that change? Was it just the idea that these could sort of be your bats in a way, or was it the fact that they were so decimated by white nose syndrome? I mean, what made the change?
I got involved in a contract with a branch of the federal government. Within the Natural Resources Conservation Service, there's a program called WHIP, W-H-I-P, and that acronym stands for Wildlife Habitat Incentive Program. I believe the name of the program has been changed to EQIP because there are connotations attached to WHIP that that are unfortunate, and we may get into that. But the contract paid me a small amount of money, embarrassingly small amount of money, to spend hundreds and hundreds of hours enhancing the habitat for bats on the farm. Specifically, when you have a shagbark hickory tree, bats will never choose it if it's out in the open, because they are at too great risk of being picked off by owls or hawks or other predators of bats when they emerge at dusk to go hunting. But if the tree is in the forest and completely surrounded by forest canopy, they won't choose that tree because they like to have some direct sunlight on the bole of the trunk for warmth. So for a shagbark tree to be optimized for bat purposes, it needs to have a very specific combination of direct sunlight but also connection to surrounding forest canopy. And ultimately, it was Scott Darling who walked the woods, and we'd come to a hickory tree, and he'd look around, and he'd stare up into the forest canopy and say, you know, if I was a bat, I think I'd go that way, then I'd go this way. Then he'd say, all right, take down that ash tree over there, but leave the white oak take down those couple of hard hacks, but leave that maple to create the special conditions that would optimize that particular hickory tree for bat purposes. And a second part of it was to create a couple of foraging zones where the entire forest midstory was removed in places where we already had found that bats were hunting, to give them an easier time hunting insects.
Yeah, so there was a sort of a twofold mission here. First was making sure they had that habitat with the shagbark hickories where they could roost, and then also have good places to forage for the
insects.
The
entire definition of habitat became a point of controversy between the several government agencies involved in this project, some of which said, well, habitat, that means having a place to sleep. And others said, well, why shouldn't it involve having something to eat and a place to eat it?
And that's where you thought we should have some place for them to eat, but that was sort of changing the original plan. It did take some extra work.
It was not in the script of the initial forest management plan that our county forester needed to approve to get us into the current use program. So it's amazing that in our society we have a government policy apparatus and programmatic response to a rogue event in the ecosystem like white nose syndrome. That's incredible. I'm sure in ancient Rome they didn't have that. I'll bet in Afghanistan today they haven't got that. But face it, it's going to be a bureaucracy. And along with that is going to come a degree of red tape, a degree of inflexibility in terms of having a certain playbook of how to respond and what to do, and overlapping areas of responsibility between different agencies, and a consequent sense of turf and trying to protect and enhance the turf. So, I mean, that comes with the deal. But at the end of this, it was a successful project, and that success redounds to the credit of these bureaucracies as much as it does to myself, certainly.
But you do talk about in the book how you chafed against this at times. It's your woods. You're trying to do this work, and then somebody else is telling you not only do you need to do it exactly to the specifications, but, oh, by the way, you have these invasive species, and we need you to get rid of all of them.
Yes, I had no idea how the invasive piece was going to actually play out. But one of the requirements before you're allowed to open the forest canopy to any degree under a contract such as the one that I had was to control invasives within those zones. And in my case, we were talking about 5 acres of forest in which buckthorn, a very serious problem in the Champlain Valley, and garlic mustard and exotic honeysuckle and Japanese barberry had to be eradicated. And that work took me roughly 2 years of on and off effort. And it was some of the most dementing, spirit numbing work I could ever imagine asking someone to do. I mean, in 2009, I was on the faculty at Middlebury College. In 2010, I was on my hands and knees day after day, crawling through the woods, plucking out garlic mustard and sticking the plants in plastic bags so the seeds would never get a chance to germinate. And I thought, that's a step down in the world.
You did, in fact, even try to get other people to do it fairly unsuccessfully.
They could have walked away after 10 minutes.
Yeah, you thought, oh, maybe we can get some neighbor kids who are here for visiting their family. We can get them to do it. They gave up within an hour or two.
Yes.
You tried to have a meditative session where you could come and meditate and pick garlic mustard.
That was my wife Cheryl's great idea. That didn't go over that well either.
No, and in fact, your wife Cheryl, when she was helping too, because it's such backbreaking work, You describe her having to lie on her side picking the garlic
mustard. Like a
swimmer
doing the side stroke.
It sounds like thankless work, but in fact, it was all to this end product.
Yes, but I want to say that this invasives control had nothing really to do with the enhancement of habitat for bats. Bats are high up in these hickory trees. Even the buckthorn is only going to be at the tallest 20 feet tall. And during the 2 years that I spent battling invasives, bats just about disappeared from sightings in Vermont. So I had grave doubts that what I was doing was going to accomplish anything at all, as if, you know, the horse had gotten out and then I had closed the barn door.
Your book is not designed to be, a lesson plan for people who want to join the current use program by any means, but you do describe this bureaucracy, and I wondered if you think that people who might have the land and the desire to do something like this will read the book and say, oh my gosh, forget it. There's so much red tape, so much paperwork, so many people telling you what to do that it's just not worth it.
I don't believe that just any reader might respond that way, but I think anybody contemplating getting involved in such a contract would want to read this book.
We're talking with Don Mitchell. We're going to take your questions and thoughts in just a moment. Our number, if you'd like to share them, is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page and post your thoughts there. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Don Mitchell, an author and retired Middlebury College lecturer who's written a new book about turning his land into an attractive habitat for endangered bats. He had to wade through a lot of tangled forest and government bureaucracy to get there, but he's now got some great stories and a great place for bats struggling with white nose syndrome to find shelter and food. If you have questions for Don about his relationship with what he used to call flying rats, or how he managed to navigate the paperwork and obligations of putting his land into the current use program, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Katie, who wants to know a little bit about how you got rid of those invasives. Because Katie says, I too am battling an ocean of invasives here in southern Vermont. I just read that goats can work wonders rather than pesticides and wondered why Mr. Mitchell can't use his sheep to help him manage his. Also, I'm wondering if there are any rent-a-goat programs in Vermont. I don't want to poison my land. And Katie's talking about a debate that you had, Don Mitchell, with yourself about this idea of using pesticides to get rid of.
Right. The NRCS said that if I wanted to eradicate buckthorn, I would almost certainly have to use glyphosate, which is a broad-spectrum herbicide sold often under the name Roundup, but also under other names because it's now off-patent. And I'd never used herbicides of any kind on our farm and didn't want to, and my wife certainly didn't want to. But when push came to shove, that was the way that was going to effectively eradicate the buckthorn. And when I read the fine print in my contract, if I didn't do this to their satisfaction, I was going to have to pay the government some money for having wasted their time. So that was an incentive. So the treatment involves cutting down a buckthorn tree between Labor Day and maybe mid-October, when the plant is already moving nutrients from the branches and leaves into the root system. And then within 5 minutes of cutting it down, painting the stump with a strong concentration of glyphosate, 22%, which is much more than you'd use as a foliar spray. And that kills it dead. We have also experimented with having our sheep graze the edges of our forest because we have a flexible grazing system and we can erect the fences where we want to. And they will defoliate the young shoots of buckthorn and other invasives. But the defoliation of a buckthorn plant does not kill it. And if you have a buckthorn tree, one that's several years old, and you cut it down and walk away, it will resprout from the root system every time. It's a very persistent plant.
So you found the pesticide was the best way to actually
kill it. The herbicide.
The herbicide, yeah, sorry. We got some questions about bats and comments about bats. Marcia says, bats are vital. We have to do everything we can to protect them. I note their absence at camp around the bonfire. They used to dive bomb for mosquitoes as we watched in amazement. Now the bugs rule. Paul says, you know, one might think they're creepy, but we need them to eat mosquitoes. And Steve says, when I redo the outside of my house, I plan to put in some bat houses. They're great for bug control. And then we got a note from BHA who says, my understanding is that bats need a cool and stable temperature through the winter. Are there specific land features on your property that make bat hibernation possible, or did you have to create hibernation space?
Oh, no. The bats in the Champlain Valley migrate to their hibernacula, which tend to be at the south end of the Marble Belt, so around Danby, Mount Tabor, Manchester area. They don't winter over in the Champlain Valley, to my knowledge.
So you were creating summer roosting spots and, in fact, places where there could be maternal colonies, a couple hundred bats, perhaps.
Yes, as the females of any particular species approach the time to give birth, they gather into a colony, and they'll all choose the same tree. And that's when a shagbark hickory can become a bat hotel.
Do you know now whether your shagbark hickories are bat hotels?
I know that in the summer of 2012, after I'd finished this habitat work, Scott Darling gave me a call and asked to come back with a team of biologists and try and trap bats again. And I said I would love that because I hadn't seen a bat in 3 years. And they arrived with their nets, which are they can be 30 feet wide and 30 feet high. And they're some kind of gossamer fabric that the bats can't detect until they're ensnared. And they began trapping bats with almost every 15 minutes on that evening in June of 2012. And so for the first time in this entire project, I was looking at bats and staring at them in the eye and saying, oh, yes, they're still here. And maybe this is now when you want to have me read.
I'd love to have you read a passage.
This is from the book's last chapter. And the book is also a psycho-emotional journey, so I can read from the last chapter without really giving away the ending. But this is the climax of the story about the bats. So the night was going well as far as big bats were concerned. All the bats they were catching were big brown bats. And then around 10:30, Joel Flewelling, one of the state's wildlife technicians, cried bat from up in the woods and returned to the truck with something that was not a big brown bat. Scott Darling seemed to recognize the species right away, but he let his colleague work through a decision tree to make a positive ID. At first glance, Joel thought the bat might be a little brown, and given their diminished numbers, that would have been a find. But did it have a buffalo head, as though somebody had punched it in the nose? Yes, in fact, it did. And did it have pinkish lips? Yes, that too. And did the brownish toe hairs fail to reach beyond the toes? Yes, they were a good deal shorter than that. And was there a keel, like the bow of a canoe, to the shape of the calcar? The calcar is a spur of cartilage that emerges from near the ankle. Yes, indeed, there was a keel, though the entire calcar was the merest nail clipping. So what do you think, asked Darling. I'd have to say this is an Indiana bat. I would have to say that too, he said. So we all gathered around to share the moment, and everyone in his or her own way expressed their jubilation. Indiana bats had been declared endangered back in 1967, long before the ravages of white nose syndrome. Now they were as rare as hen's teeth. But here we were staring at one in the light of several headlamps. I love you, said Zepeda, one of the technicians, to the startled-looking bat, and it was a female capable of reproduction. Then Alyssa weighed it in at 8.3 grams, the weight of 3 pennies. Based on that weight and the distension of its belly, the bat was likely pregnant.
That must have been a thrilling moment after all of this work.
In my whole life, I can think of only half a dozen moments as thrilling.
Really? You didn't say I love you to the bat, though.
No, but I felt that emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have you seen them since?
Yes. We now, if we walk in the woods in the bat zones in the evening, we see bats routinely. But to answer your earlier question, the Indiana bat justified equipping her with a radio transmitter, which was quite an operation. And then for the next 2 weeks, we could track which tree she had chosen at the break of day and where she had spent the day. And then at dusk, a biologist would come out to find that tree and see how many other bats would emerge from that tree with her. The bat never chose one of the shagbark hickory trees that I had enhanced. She always chose some other tree.
So still worth it, though, for you?
Oh, yes, because we only had a transmitter on one bat. And, you know, in this line of work, the idea is that if you build it, they will come. Habitat is habitat. And if you provide what a wild creature is looking for, sooner or later, they'll take advantage of it.
You know, this was such an involved project for you in terms of making sure that you could cut down the trees that Scott Darling had said you needed to cut down to daylight those shagbark hickories. I think you had 100 trees to cut down. You had to get rid of your garlic mustard. You had to get rid of buckthorn. You had to get rid of the non-native honeysuckle and do all of this invasives management. But it also became this sort of meditative project for you because you were doing this repetitive work and you had all of this time to think. You know, your thoughts ranged from how parenting is like flying blind using echolocation because you don't really know what you're doing.
Or any situation in which you have to make a decision and you haven't got enough information to know what the consequences of your choice are going to be.
You also had a lot of time to think about your relationship with your father and your father as a man, and he was a difficult man.
He was, and he had just died before I began this project. And when your father dies, you're able to open certain doors of memory and ask certain questions that you felt prohibited from entering before. And since I had hundreds of hours to think about anything, I began to interrogate our relationship, which had been in many ways an uneasy one. And my father was a profoundly authoritarian figure in my life, as fathers tend to be. And I perceived the government program that I was in a contract with as being comparably authoritarian. And it made me think about how the ways in which human beings interact with the natural world are an extension of how they interact with each other, and vice versa.
You had some uncomfortable revelations as well as you thought about your father and thought about your family and realized that your father's stepfather was not a nice man. In fact, he was an abusive, sexually abusive man.
Yes.
That must have been a very difficult revelation.
It was. It rocked my life when I realized that. Yes. But then I came to realize that my father had come from a far more difficult childhood than I had, and that he had made choices to give me a better time of it, an easier ride. So there's really two arcs of change in the book, and one is from fearing bats to coming to respect and admire them, and the other was from seeing my father as a tyrant who I could never satisfy to seeing him as a sympathetic and caring figure, in some ways a tragic figure, but certainly I got behind the Oz-like curtain that he'd been hiding behind his entire life.
It's a writer's job to tie all of these pieces together, but as you were starting the project, you had no idea that this would be a book or that it would be something that would affect your life in this way.
That's right. But I think that whatever work a person needs to do in their interior life is going to be seen through the lens of the work that they're doing in the world. And in this case, the lines of connection and the richness of connection between those two things were uncommonly fine.
Bottom line, you had started this as a way to save some money on your taxes. Did you save any?
A little bit.
Yeah. Like a couple $100?
It's a more complicated story than that, but yes. less than I thought I would save.
But you got a lot more out of it than just that.
That's right.
Don Mitchell lives on a farm in New Haven. His book about turning his land into a haven for bats is called Flying Blind: One Man's Adventures Battling Buckthorn, Making Peace with Authority, and Creating a Home for Endangered Bats. Don, thank you so much for sharing it
with us.
Thank
you, Jane.
Coming up, housing assistance for low-income Vermonters hasn't been able to keep up with demand for years. But with sequestration, the budgets are being squeezed even tighter, meaning less money for people trying to find shelter this year. We'll talk about two different programs facing cuts next up on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Low-income families in Vermont face a severe shortage of affordable housing options. Rental assistance is even harder to find. Some people have been on the waiting list for federal Section 8 housing vouchers for years. And this year, sequestration has cut even deeper into funding for Section 8. Richard Williams is the executive director of the Vermont State Housing Authority. He's on the line with us now. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Jane, for having us on.
Well, so the way this works, the Vermont State Housing Authority and regional housing authorities, there are eight of them, issue about 6,000 Section 8 housing vouchers. How, first of all, has that funding been affected by sequestration?
Jane, because of the sequestration cuts instituted back on March 1st of this year, state and local housing authorities, public housing authorities nationwide are facing substantial shortfalls in funding to renew the Housing Choice Voucher Program. This program nationwide, for example, serves 2.1 million low-income households in private market housing. In Vermont, that means there's actually nine local housing authorities. The St. Albans Housing Authority has a small Housing Choice Voucher Program, too. And with the housing authorities and Vermont State Housing Authority, we should be serving about 6,792 households, but because of the lack of funding, because of sequestration, and the last several years of lower appropriations, we can only serve a little over 6,000 households. So about 774 families are not receiving assistance. So
does that mean you actually had to cut their vouchers? You pull them from people?
Fortunately, here in Vermont, we did not actually have to terminate a voucher. So as vouchers turn over in the program and come back, we basically shelve those vouchers. And we're going to continue. We started doing that last October, actually, before the sequester. And, you know, nationwide, folks weren't doing that. And some housing authorities got into trouble because of that. But we're fortunate here in Vermont that, to the best of my knowledge, no local housing authority nor the Vermont State Housing Authority has had to cut anybody off the program.
So, in other words, if somebody either makes enough money that they get off the program or move or otherwise, for some reason, no longer need the voucher, ordinarily, you might be able to then give that voucher to the next person on the waiting list, and now you can't because you're basically trying to cut the number of vouchers.
That's correct, Jane. Typically, in past years, you know, they would come back, they'd be reissued to another person on that family on the wait list, and they would look for private market housing.
We last spoke with you, I think, about 3 years ago in September of 2010 when you closed your waiting list to new applicants because it was just so long that there was no way you were going to get to all of the people even on the list for a number of years, let alone new people who were coming on. That list was opened for some people who were displaced by Tropical Storm Irene, but except for that, it's remained closed. So you have, what, 1,500 people on the waiting list?
Yes, Jane. About 1,535 applicants still on the waiting list looking for rental assistance.
How long would it take to actually get through to the end of that list?
Well, when we had adequate appropriations and were funding turnover vouchers, we would see about 50 vouchers turnover a month. So roughly 600 vouchers a year. So you could see it's still 2.5-3 years out.
And now, because you're not able to issue new vouchers or turn over those vouchers, it's even longer.
Yeah, it's until we actually see what comes out of, as you know, what's going on in Washington right now. You know, there are budget committees trying to work out appropriations bill before the middle of January of 2014. And if there are different budgets for the HUD transportation, the House really slashed funding, and the Senate version has had it actually increased it. So if we can come out with some additional money, we may be able to start reissuing some vouchers, but until we know what our appropriations levels will be for 2014, we're going to continue to take any vouchers that come back to us, and we'll hold those until such time we know what our funding is.
I'm talking with Richard Williams, Executive Director of the Vermont State Housing Authority, and we're looking at Section 8 housing vouchers. It's a federal program administered in Vermont for people with very low income who are looking for housing assistance. Richard, given that the list is closed, the waiting list, do we even have any idea of what the demand for housing actually is and how many people would be eligible for these vouchers?
Well, back, when we were actually taking applications, we had 4,000 to 5,000 people on our waiting list. So that was just the Vermont State Housing Authority. So, demand is great for these rental assistance. I think there's about there's roughly about 14,000 low-income renter households in Vermont, and medium income of those households are about a little over $1,200 a month. And our medium housing costs are about $1,000, so that doesn't leave a whole lot of money left, about $200 to pay for other necessities.
And people who do get Section 8 housing vouchers have to contribute some of their income towards the rental that they're getting, and then the Section 8 voucher is supposed to augment that, to fill up the rest of it.
That's correct. They pay approximately 40% of their gross income. And our per-unit cost is the amount of rental subsidies, about $537 a month that we would pay directly to the landlord.
We got a couple of emails from listeners when we mentioned on our Facebook page that we were going to be doing an interview about Section 8 housing. Beth writes from the landlord's perspective and says, I've rented apartments to Section 8 recipients twice, and I won't do it again based on my horrible experience both times. Both recipients were new to Section 8 and had no established relationship with the agency. There was too much red tape to deal with as a landlord and not enough weeding out of troubled tenants. Do you find that it's difficult to find landlords who will accept families and individuals with Section 8 housing vouchers?
No, that's not typically the case. And the federal government really hasn't helped either because they've been lowering what they call the fair market rent. So our payment standards have gone down over the years. And you know, our landlords have been working with us and other local housing authorities and, you know, adjusting. You know, normally, you know, they might be entitled to a rent increase and, you know, in order to not have to evict someone from the house or their apartments. You know, they've worked with us and lowered their rent. So, like I said, you know, we have a pretty long track record working with landlords, and it's been a successful relationship.
We got a note from Gabby who says, I lived in a Section 8 housing unit until I got a job and got kicked off of daycare assistance, and my rent went up, and I couldn't afford both. Section 8 is a joke. You're punished for working and rewarded for not working. And Amanda says, like Gabby said, once you're in, heaven forbid that you better yourself and make a little more money. If you do, you're either forced to move, lose your voucher, or your rent is raised so high you can't afford it anyway. Then you're back to square one again, having no way to afford a place to live. No wonder it takes so long to get help. No one can leave the program once they're in. And who can blame them with rent being what it is here? What do you think about that, Richard Williams? Is there an incentive not to find a job because you'll lose your house if you make more money or you'll lose your apartment?
We really haven't seen that. We actually have some family self-sufficiency programs that we work with families and that they are able to, if they go to work, they're able to save some of that money that they would normally pay for rent. And if we've seen many families graduate out of the program and be able to take some of those savings with them. So it's... we haven't seen that incentives not to work. And it's just, you know, rents are high in Vermont, and needs the income to be able to support the rents. And so, folks do stay on the program, but we've seen a lot of success as well.
Just in the couple of seconds we have left with you, do you see any end to these budget cuts? Any chance that we're either going to get to the end of the waiting list or be able to accept more people onto that list anytime in the future?
I don't think that we'll see the appropriations that we've seen in the past. I expect it will probably continue on a continuing resolution for the rest of this calendar year, and it will probably be based on, you know, our fiscal 13 appropriations. So I'm not looking for a lot of new rental assistance coming into the state. Fortunately, Vermont does have, some programs that do help. Governor Shumlin in the legislature, a couple of years ago put in place a Vermont rental subsidy program. I think that's serving about around 160 persons, or about 65 rental subsidies. So in that situation, we're a little bit better than some other states.
Richard Williams is the executive director of the Vermont State Housing Authority. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for checking in with us.
Now, Section 8 is perhaps the best-known rental assistance program available to low-income Americans, but there are others out there. The U.S. Department of Agriculture provides rental assistance and home ownership and improvement loans through the Rural Development Program. It's the only program in the state that provides loans to developers building new housing units for low-income residents. Except that they haven't issued any loans for new construction in the last 2 years, and they actually ran out of money in September. Ted Brady is the state director for the USDA Rural Development Program in Vermont and New Hampshire. He's with us now. Hi, Ted. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Now, one of your programs, called Section 515, provides loans, as I said, to developers to build new multifamily housing units for low-income Vermonters. And then it provides rental subsidies to the residents of those developments. That program ran out of money in September, but only briefly?
That's right. You know, the 515 program is a really powerful tool to giving low-income Vermonters access to affordable places to live, affordable, safe places to live. We make a loan directly to a nonprofit or for-profit developer, and in return, we also give them rental assistance to the residents, and that allows a resident to pay no more than 30% of their income for the rent. Last year, we were under the threat that we didn't have enough money to cover the full cost, largely thanks to sequestration and budget reductions. And we had to let borrowers, the landlords, know that there was a chance that we wouldn't be able to meet the obligations to fund rental assistance for those residents.
So what did that mean for both the landlords and for the people in the units?
Fortunately, it's a great program, and we have incredible for-profit and nonprofit landlords in Vermont. Really, it didn't. The resident didn't see an enormous change. Landlords faced some difficulties, though. They were under threat of not being able to make their debt payments. They were under threat of not being able to pay contractors, you name it. Fortunately, once again, in Vermont, we only had three properties that ended up facing a true threat of not getting a rental assistance contract repaid. And in the end, we were able to make everybody whole.
You rolled out into a new fiscal year on October 1st, but that was in the middle of the federal government shutdown. So my understanding is for this program, you couldn't actually get your new funding to start up again until the shutdown was over. So now what? Is this program fully funded?
Well, sure. So the way this program works, Rural Development is an agency that covers housing, community development, and business development. And we fund those things out of the same allocation, a $2.4 billion allocation out of the Congress. Of that, about $1 billion is for rental assistance. And the reality is our rental obligation, our rental assistance obligation that helps these folks live in these great homes, That subsidy is at risk because rents continue to grow and incomes in difficult years like recessions continue to go down, which means in the end, we're asked to pay more in the rental assistance. Unfortunately, with sequestration and other cuts, our actual budget number has gone down, meaning for fiscal year 14, which we're in now, we're probably going to be faced with a similar situation to the end of the year. If we're fortunate, we'll be able to work through this. We've got great staff here that can work through it with the lenders and find a way to hold everybody harmless. But certainly there is a threat that there isn't enough funding to meet the needs out there.
Yeah, you said if you're lucky, you'll be able to manage and to make people whole or to stretch it out. But what happens if you're not?
Sure. You know, if the worst case scenario happens, we have tools that will enable lenders, the borrowers, the folks that are the landlords, to possibly defer debt, to possibly go into their reserves to make payments. The reality is we have contingencies in place. However, with rents rising, incomes decreasing in that really vulnerable population, there is always the threat. And really what we need to do is get past sequestration and get past some of these budget cuts and allow this program to do what it's supposed to do, which is to house the most vulnerable Americans, both the seniors and the disabled, and also folks that are just trying to reach up.
The USDA does offer other types of housing assistance through this program. You have single-family housing assistance. You have direct loans and loan guarantees that you offer to Vermonters. Is funding for all of your programs at risk at this point?
Sure. You know, with the difficult budget years we've faced, there have been reductions. Fortunately, this agency and really the entire USDA has found a way to cut approaching $1 billion in costs over the last 3 or 4 years in staffing and such. So we've managed to really eat a lot of that in our administrative savings, which has allowed our programs not to take a hit, which means we're getting a lot of money out to Vermonters. In fiscal year 13, USDA Rural Development did about $150 million in business. Part of that was the single-family program. It is at risk of sequestration and other budget cuts, but we still managed to do 50 direct loans last year, equating to about $6 million, a little more than $6 million. We hope we'll be able to do that same number next year. And if you have listeners who are below median income, you know, a family of four making less than $50,000 a year that's looking to buy a home in Vermont, there's a chance, depending on where they live, that USDA Rural Development could help them get into a loan that if a commercial lender says no to them, maybe they want to give us a call.
Well, and we have a link actually on our website at vpr.net. People can click on Vermont Edition to get more information about that. Ted, we were hearing from Richard Williams how difficult it is for people looking for Section 8 housing vouchers. You've been talking about the fact that, you know, rents are going up, incomes are going down. Richard was talking about that, too. Are we in a crisis here that we're not seeing an end to?
I think that it's certainly a difficult time in the affordable housing developers and affordable housing providers world. But I don't think it's going to continue forever. I think we'll find a way to get through this. And I think a lot of that depends on getting through sequestration and getting these budgets turned around and working better. So I hope that we're able to continue providing this. There are 1,400 Vermont families that depend on rural development rental assistance. We hope one day that that number can go up and not just go down by being able to make new projects and keep housing, keep providing more housing.
Although, of course, I guess in the end you hope the number does go down so that there are fewer Vermonters who need that kind of assistance.
That's a great point, Jane, and certainly something we hope. But when needed, we hope we can fill that gap and help folks house folks.
Ted Brady is the state director, for the USDA Rural Development Program in Vermont and New Hampshire. Ted, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jane.
Now, the crunch continues for low-income Vermonters. Tomorrow on this program, we're going to look at funding for heating assistance. As temperatures drop and we turn on the heat in our homes, federal funding for low-income heating assistance has been reduced again. We'll look at what funding is available for lower-income Vermonters and at how they'll cope after some fuel companies have dropped LIHEAP customers this winter. You can send your questions about LIHEAP, the federal program, to vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.